Convenience Audio presents The Rational Bible, Genesis by Dennis Prager, performed by Tom Parks. To Sue, it is not good for a man to be alone. I will make him a helper who is his equal. Genesis chapter 2, verse 18, literal translation. Introduction. To the reader, this introduction will greatly enhance your understanding and enjoyment of this commentary. Genesis is the first book of the Bible. This commentary on Genesis, however, is the second volume of my five-volume commentary on the first five books of the Bible, the Torah. The beginning of Genesis is probably the best-known story in world history, containing, as it does, God's creation of the world, Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden, Cain and Abel, the flood, and Noah's Ark. What is not well known is how this story changed the world. The first verse, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," alone changed the world. As I explain, this verse asserted for the first time in history that there is one God, that this God is universal as opposed to a tribal God, and that God created nature and is in no way part of it, unlike every other god in history. Genesis also contains the story of the beginning of the Hebrews, the Israelites, the Jews as they later became known, the people who, through the Hebrew Bible, most influenced the world. From the first Hebrew, Abraham, we are taught that arguing with God is not only acceptable, but it is expected. The very name of this people, Israel, means struggle with God. Genesis is filled with human drama that touches and helps every one of us on a personal level. For example, every family in Genesis is what we today would call dysfunctional. I regard this as a divine gift. If your family is dysfunctional, the fact that all the families in Genesis are dysfunctional should provide you with some comfort and solace. I think the Bible is telling us that family dysfunction is a normal, though not necessarily inevitable, part of the human condition. Indeed, all of Genesis is a statement of how troubled the human condition is. The rest of the Bible, especially the next four books, provides solutions to the troubled human condition. To put it in medical terms, Genesis describes the patient's, the human being's, pathology, and the books that follow offer the wisdom and moral instruction necessary to cure the patient. Some of the following appeared in the introduction to Exodus. Why this commentary? I have been teaching the Torah all of my adult life and have devoted decades to writing this explanation of and commentary on the Torah. I have done so because I believe if people properly understand the Torah and attempt to live by its values and precepts, the world will be an infinitely kinder and more just place. Since childhood, I've been preoccupied, almost obsessed, with the problem of evil, people deliberately hurting other people. At the age of 16, I wrote in my diary that I wanted to devote my life to influencing people to the good. That mission has animated my life. In a nutshell, I love goodness and hate evil. My favorite verse in the Bible is, "Those of you who love God hate evil," Psalms 97, verse 10. Because of my and the Torah's preoccupation with evil, in this commentary, I frequently cite the two most recent examples of mass evil, Nazism and communism. I assume all readers of this commentary have some acquaintance with Nazi evil. Tragically, however, relatively few people have much knowledge of communist evil. So I should note here that communist regimes murdered about 100 million people and enslaved and destroyed the lives of more than a billion. If you hate evil, you must confront what Nazis and communists wrought in the 20th century and what others wrought before them and are doing at this time. I have had one other mission in life, to understand human beings as best as possible. These two missions, promoting goodness and attaining wisdom, are linked because it is impossible to do good without wisdom. All the good intentions in the world are likely to be worthless without wisdom. Many of the horrors of the 20th century were supported by people with good intentions who lacked wisdom. Here too, because it has so much wisdom, the Torah and the rest of the Bible is indispensable. However, we live in an age that not only has little wisdom, it doesn't even have many people who value it. People greatly value knowledge and intelligence, but not wisdom. And the lack of wisdom, certainly in America and the rest of the West, is directly related to the decline in biblical literacy. In the American past, virtually every home, no matter how poor, owned a Bible. It was the primary vehicle by which parents passed wisdom on to their children. In the modern period, however, people have increasingly replaced Bible-based homes and Bible-based schools with godless homes and with schools in which no reference to the Bible is ever made. As a result, we are less wise and more morally confused. As I showed in Exodus, in my discussion of secular education as a potential false god, the best educated people in the West have often both lacked wisdom and been among the greatest supporters of evil ideologies and regimes. Given the supreme importance of goodness and the indispensability of wisdom to goodness, the Torah, the greatest repository of goodness and wisdom in human history, is the most important book ever written. It gave birth to the rest of the Bible, to Christianity, and to Western civilization. It gave us love your neighbor as yourself, the Ten Commandments, a just and loving God, and other bedrocks of humane civilization. Who is this Torah commentary for? I've written this book for people of every faith, and for people of no faith. Throughout my years teaching the Torah, I would tell my students, the Torah either has something to say to everyone, or it has nothing to say to Jews. The idea that the Torah is only for Jews is as absurd as the idea that Shakespeare is only for the English, or Beethoven is only for Germans. That is why, over time, half the people taking my Torah classes, at a Jewish university no less, were not Jews. Nevertheless, I would like to address some groups specifically. To Jewish readers, because the Torah has formed the basis of Jewish life for 3,000 years, there are very many Jewish commentaries, a good number of which have passed the hardest test, the test of time. However, the modern world poses intellectual and moral challenges that did not exist when the classic Jewish commentaries, most dating to the Middle Ages, were written. Therefore, most modern Jews read neither those commentaries nor the Torah. I hope this commentary will address nearly all the intellectual and moral objections of these Jews. In general, it has not gone well for Jews or for the world when Jews ceased believing in the Torah. Belief in the Torah as a divine document has probably been the single most important reason Jews have stayed alive for 3,000 years, and it has formed the core of Jews' moral values. When Jews abandoned belief in the Torah, they or their offspring almost always ceased being Jews, and too often, they created or joined social movements with non-Torah or even anti-Torah values. To Jews who already believe in the Torah as a divine document, I hope this commentary gives you chizuk, strengthened faith, and I hope it encourages you to go into the world to teach Torah-based values. To all other Jews, I hope this commentary leads you to an intellectual appreciation of the Torah's unique greatness, and consequently causes you to at least entertain the possibility that God is its ultimate author. To Christian readers, one cannot be a serious Christian without being familiar with the Hebrew Bible, or Old Testament as the Christian world named it. Nor can one understand Jesus, a Jew who was not only observant of Torah law, but asserted he came to change not one jot or one tittle of it. For the many Christians who already believe the Torah embodies the Word of God, I hope this commentary strengthens your faith in the Torah. As Maimonides, widely considered the greatest Jewish philosopher, wrote 900 years ago, his differences with Christian theology notwithstanding, it is Christians who have been primarily responsible for disseminating knowledge of the Torah to so much of the world. I should also add, I have greatly benefited from reading Christian Bible scholars. In this volume, I frequently cite Victor Hamilton, born 1941, professor of Old Testament and theology at Asbury University from 1971 to 2007. Hamilton's masterful two-volume commentary on Genesis enormously contributed to my understanding of this great book of the Bible. At the same time, the Bible scholar who most influenced my understanding of Genesis and Exodus was a Jew, the late Professor Nahum Sarna, 1923 to 2005, professor of biblical studies at Brandeis University from 1967 to 1985. His Jewish Publication Society commentaries on Genesis and Exodus are extraordinary. To non-religious readers, I have had you most in mind when writing this commentary. With every passing generation in the West, fewer and fewer people believe in God, let alone in the Bible. This is a catastrophe for the West, and it is a tragedy for you. Having God, religion, a religious community, and a sacred text in one's life enables one to have a far deeper and happier, not to mention wiser, life. If you keep an open mind when reading this commentary, that life will hopefully become appealing to you. To readers outside of the West, the Torah has as much to say to you as to anyone in the West. Just as Beethoven has much to say to a Japanese as to a German, and Shakespeare has as much to say to an Argentinian as to an Englishman, the Torah as much to say a non-Jew and a non-Christian as to a Jew or a Christian. I look forward to your reactions. They will surely influence my writing of subsequent volumes. In writing this commentary, I have no hidden agenda. My agenda is completely open. I want as many people as possible to take the Torah seriously, to entertain the possibility it is God-given, or at the very least, to understand why so many rational people do. Nor do I have a parochial agenda. I am a believing Jew, but neither God, nor the Torah, nor later Judaism ever obligated Jews to make non-Jews Jewish. Jews have always welcomed, and until prohibited when the Roman Empire adopted Christianity from doing so, even sought converts. But what God and the Torah obligate Jews to do is to bring humanity to the God of the Torah, to his basic moral rules, and to the Torah's values and insights. People can and have lived according to the Torah's moral values as members of other faiths, most obviously Christians, or simply as non-denominational believers in God, ethical monotheists such as American founding father Benjamin Franklin. The Torah is not man-made. For reasons I develop throughout the commentary, I am convinced the Torah is divine, meaning God, not man, is its ultimate source. The Torah is so utterly different, morally, theologically, and in terms of wisdom, from anything else preceding it and, for that matter, from anything written since, that a reasonable person would have to conclude either moral Superman or God was responsible for it. To cite just a few examples of what the Torah introduced to the world, a universal God, the God of all people. This began the long road to human beings believing that with one Father in heaven, all human beings are brothers and sisters. An invisible, incorporeal God. Therefore, the physical is not the only reality. Life is infinitely more than the material world in which we live during our brief lifetime on earth. A moral God. All gods prior to Torah's God were capricious, not moral. A just and moral God meant, among other things, ultimately justice will prevail, if not in this life, in the next. It also meant human beings imbued with a sense of justice can argue with and question this just God. The name Israel means wrestle or struggle with God. A God beyond nature. God made nature and is therefore not natural. This led to the end of the universal human belief in nature gods, such as rain gods. And sure enough, as belief in the Torah's God declines, nature worship seems to be returning. A God who loves and who wants to be loved. This was another world-changing concept introduced by the Torah to the world. Universal human worth. Every human being is created in God's image. Nothing like this had ever been posited prior to the Torah. Universal human rights. Another world-altering consequence of universal human worth. I do not believe some people made all of that up. In the words of a contemporary Jewish thinker, Rabbi Saul Berman, "The more I study the Torah, the more I am convinced that it is the revealed word of God. The more I study ancient cultures, the more I see the absolutely radical disparity between the values of pagan civilizations and the values which Torah brought into the world. Torah was God's weapon in the war against idolatrous culture, and war it was." I would only add that the Torah's battle and sometimes war with many of the dominant ideas of our time is as great as it was with the cultures of 3 millennia ago, when the Torah came into the world. The other major reason I'm convinced the Torah is not man-made is it so often depicts the people of the book, the Jews, Israelites, Hebrews, in a negative light. Had Jews made up what is, after all, their book and their story, they would never have portrayed themselves as critically and even negatively as the Torah and the rest of the Hebrew Bible often does. There is no parallel to this in any ancient national or any religious literature in the world. Man-made or God-made? Why it matters. What difference does it make if the Torah is man-made or God-made? I can best answer this question by recounting a personal experience. Most people, especially in their younger years, pass through a difficult time with one or both of their parents. In my teen years and 20s, I was one of them. But no matter how I felt, there was never a time I did not honor my parents. For example, from the age of 21, when I left my parents' home, I called my parents every week of their lives. I treated my parents with such respect because I have always believed God commanded me to do so. Honor your father and mother, the 5th of the 10 Commandments. The Torah, as the first 5 books of the Bible have always been known in Hebrew, commands us to love our neighbor, to love God, and to love the stranger. But we are never commanded to love our parents. We are commanded to honor them. And we are not commanded to honor anyone else. There is no comparison between God commanded and Moses or anyone else commanded. If I believed the 10 Commandments were written by men, I would not have honored my parents as much as I did during periods of emotional ambivalence. Those who believe God is the source of the Torah's commandments are far more likely to obey them than those who believe they are all man-made. A second difference is that only because I believe the Torah is God-made have I worked to understand and explain difficult passages of the Torah. If you believe the Torah is man-made, when you encounter a morally or intellectually problematic verse or passage, you have an easy explanation. Men wrote it, ancient men at that, and you are then free to dismiss it. But those of us who believe God is the source of the Torah don't have that option. We need to try to understand the verse or passage morally and intellectually. Let me offer one of many examples. There is a Torah law that says if you have a particularly bad, wayward son, you may take him to the elders, the court of your city. And if they find him guilty, they are to stone him to death. When modern men and women read that, they dismiss it as morally primitive. What do you expect from something people wrote 3,000 years ago? But since I don't believe it is something people wrote, I don't have that option. Consequently, I have had to look for rational explanations for seemingly irrational laws and passages, and for moral explanations for seemingly immoral laws and passages. And I have almost always found them. In this case, for example, I came to understand this law was one of the great moral leaps forward in the history of mankind. In this law, the Torah brilliantly preserved parental authority while permanently depriving parents of the right to kill their child, a commonplace occurrence in the ancient world and even today, such as honor killings in parts of the Muslim world. The law permits only a duly established court, the elders, not parents, to take the life of their child. And we have no record of a Jewish court executing a wayward son. My belief in the divinity of the Torah led me to seek a moral explanation of what appears to us to be an immoral law, and solely because of that belief, I found one. This has happened repeatedly regarding seemingly immoral or irrational laws, verses, and passages. A third difference is only those who believe in the text as God-given will continue to live by it, carefully study it, and try to impart its wisdom generation after generation. There will always be a few individuals who believe the Torah is man-made who will nevertheless diligently study it, but it is doubtful their grandchildren will. If Jews long ago believed the Torah was man-made, there would be no Jews today. I would go further. If you believe in God, but you don't believe in any divinely revealed text, how do you know what your God wants of you? How do you know what God wants of humanity? Of course, you or your society can make up laws and values, including some good ones the Torah would approve of. But if God told us nothing, we become our own gods when it comes to determining moral values. How was the Torah transmitted? I take no position on how God revealed the Torah. What concerns me most is not how God transmitted the Torah. Who authored the Torah is infinitely more important than how it was written. Reason, Torah, and God. The title of this commentary is The Rational Bible. There are two reasons for this. First, my approach to understanding and explaining the Torah is reason-based. I never ask the reader to accept anything I write on faith alone. If something I write does not make rational sense, I've not done my job. On those few, thankfully very few occasions I do not have a rational explanation for a Torah verse, I say so. Second, reason has always been my primary vehicle to God and to religion. My beliefs in God, the revelation at Sinai, the Torah, etc., are not rooted in faith alone. We have Reason to Believe, the title of a book written in 1958 by the British Jewish theologian Louis Jacobs, had a deep impact on me. The title has an important double meaning. The obvious one is there are reasons to have religious faith. The less obvious meaning of the title is the one I cherish. We human beings have the faculty of reason and are to use it in order to believe. Of course, there is a faith component to my religious life. The primary example is the foundation of this commentary, my belief in the Torah as a divine document. While reason has led me to this belief, I acknowledge there are a few verses or passages that challenge this belief. Whenever I encounter such passages, however, I am not prepared to say, "Love the stranger is divine, but this difficult part is man-made." Once one says that, the Torah not only ceases to be divine, it ceases to be authoritative. When you say, "This part is divine, but that one isn't," you become your own Torah. As I put it in a number of public dialogues with a secular Jewish scholar, Professor Alan Dershowitz of Harvard Law School, I think I can sum up our difference this way. When Professor Dershowitz differs with the Torah, He thinks the Torah is wrong, and he is right. When I differ with the Torah, I think the Torah is right, and I am wrong. Professor Dershowitz agreed with that summation. My approach is to abandon neither faith nor reason. I neither abandon the claim of reason because of the dictates of faith, nor abandon the faith claim because of reason. In the Torah, faith and reason nearly always live together in harmony, but when they do not, I do not deny either. Moreover, there is a faith component to everyone's, including the atheist's, life. Any atheist who believes good and evil really exist, or life has a purpose beyond one he or she has made up, or that free will exists, or for that matter, that science alone will explain how the universe came about, or how life arose from non-life, or how intelligence arose from non-intelligence, has taken a leap of faith. Why read this commentary? Why should people devote time to reading my explanation of the Torah? Here's my answer. I have devoted more than 50 years to studying and teaching the Torah. That includes a lifelong immersion in Torah Hebrew, both its grammar and its vocabulary. I could not have written this commentary without this extensive knowledge of Hebrew. But most importantly, I have sought to make the Torah completely relevant to my life and to the lives of others. In my case, others means millions of others. Every good teacher learns from his or her students, and I am no exception. But I have been blessed to have something very rare among teachers or scholars. Millions of students of almost every nationality, ethnicity, religion, and philosophy. For over 3 decades, I have been a radio talk show host, broadcasting for more than half of that time on radio stations throughout America and on the Internet internationally. This has enabled me to discuss virtually every subject imaginable with a very large number of people, live on the radio and through tens of thousands of emails. It also has enabled me to dialogue about religious matters with many of the leading theologians and scholars, especially Jewish and Christian, of my time, and to debate many contemporary leading atheists. I've been able to bounce ideas off and learn from lay people and scholars of every background. Given this uncommon, if not unique, background, I decided after much soul-searching to write this commentary from the first-person perspective where appropriate. I became convinced that showing how the Torah's ideas and values have played themselves out in one individual's life makes the commentary more interesting, more real, and more relevant. Shortly before finishing the first volume, Exodus, I had the great honor of being invited to speak about my Torah commentary to the Bible faculty and students of Israel's religious university, Bar Ilan University. They did not invite me because they thought I know more than, or even as much as, any one of them does about the Torah. They invited me because they believed I bring a fresh understanding of the Torah. That is why I wrote this commentary. A few details. Why Exodus was Volume 1. The primary reason I began my commentary with the second book of the Torah, Exodus, and not the first, Genesis, is Exodus contains the Ten Commandments, the most important moral code in world history, and the central moral code of the Torah. If people lived by those 10 laws alone, the world would be almost devoid of man-made suffering. In addition, Genesis is almost all narrative, while Exodus is in equal parts narrative, laws, and theology. B.C. or B.C.E. Some readers will wonder why I use the letters B.C.E. rather than the more familiar B.C. in dates. I struggled with this issue because I have no problem with B.C., but virtually all academic works and many general works now use B.C.E. B.C.E. stands for Before the Common Era, but any reader who prefers to read the letters as Before the Christian Era is certainly welcome to. That is, after all, what Common Era denotes. God as He. I refer to God as He because that is how the Torah refers to God. I explain why the Torah does so in an essay in Chapter 1 of Genesis. On how to read this commentary. The reader can benefit from reading this commentary in any way he or she desires. It can, of course, be read straight through or be used as a reference work for one's own Bible study. But those are not the only ways to read it. Readers can equally benefit from choosing to read any subject heading that strikes them as interesting. And that is made easier by simply perusing the table of contents to see the subjects covered. The use of post-biblical Jewish sources. I often cite non-Jewish sources, but more frequently I cite Jewish sources such as the Talmud. The Jews, after all, had the Torah for more than 1,000 years prior to the rise of Christianity. The Talmud is the encyclopedia-sized compendium of Jewish law and philosophy that reflects those 1,000-plus years of Jews studying and living the Torah. Dennis Prager, February 2019. Preface, Joel Alperson. I've always tried to find the answers to the big questions of life. When I was all of 9 years old, after a close friend showed me some magic tricks, I found the magic book he had read so I could perform the same tricks. Later, as a college freshman, I discovered Plato, who addressed many of the big questions I deeply cared about with arguments that were linear and well thought through. Later, as a college senior, I studied one-on-one with a professor who told me of a legend which held Plato had written a book on the good. I was so excited. I thought if I could only read this book, I could learn the secret of leading a good life. Unfortunately, the legend also held that this volume had been lost in a great fire. So my search for the good began and ended in the span of that one-hour study session. Who would have guessed that decades later, I would not only find myself reading a brilliant explanation of what I have come to regard as the greatest book ever written, but I would also have helped to make this work possible. My Sunday school and Hebrew school teachers certainly would not have guessed. Given my awful grades and even worse behavior, they'd be shocked. My grandfather, who was Orthodox, would also be shocked. He had given me a 5-volume set of the Torah when I was a teen, but whenever he would open one of those volumes, he would hear the binding crack. He knew I hadn't even touched the books. My story is hardly unique. The majority of those living in the West have dismissed the Torah and the rest of the Bible as little more than ancient religious fairy tales. And why not? 10 plagues? The creation of the world by a supernatural God? A giant flood wiping out virtually all of mankind? 10 commandments from 3,000 years ago? Why would people choose to study, let alone think their lives could be transformed by, such stories? I certainly didn't. Then one weekend in 1982, I heard Dennis Prager speak at a retreat outside of Kansas City. I remember arguing with him all weekend, but he had answers, and they stayed with me. So began my long journey of realizing that the Torah had more meaning than I ever imagined. Eventually, Dennis taught the Torah to a class in Los Angeles, line by line, over 18 years, and I started listening to recordings of those classes in my car as I drove around my hometown of Omaha, Nebraska. Realizing that I couldn't focus on the material and my driving at the same time, I asked him if I could transcribe some of those recordings. That was in 2002. Little did I know at the time, his agreement would start the process of creating this remarkable work. I was able to enlist the help of Ilana Kershan, a very talented student of the Torah. For 1 year, she took approximately 5,000 pages of Dennis's Torah class transcripts and converted them into a first draft of this commentary. Her work was excellent and enormously helpful. It was also our very good fortune that Rabbi Joseph Telushkin was available to help with this project. For all the reasons Dennis listed in his introduction, no one else could have added to this great work as Rabbi Telushkin has. The finished product, as Dennis is the first to acknowledge, was made possible because of Rabbi Telushkin's passionate involvement. Helping Dennis Prager author this work has been an honor for me. I helped the wisest man I know comment on the wisest book ever written. Having carefully and repeatedly listened to Dennis's Torah lectures, I expected this book to be an edited version of all the wonderful ideas he offered over the years. But I was surprised by the many new and important insights he added to this project. I think even he was surprised. This work captured him. It was obvious from his tremendous investment of time, thought, and research that this was not another book. This is arguably his greatest work and his legacy. You have only to read a few essays or a single chapter to see the profundity of his writing. Dennis has repeatedly said how grateful he is to me for helping to make his, as he likes to put it, magnum opus possible. He says it is one of the greatest gifts he's ever received. Ironically, after working so closely with him over so many years, I believe the greatest gift I've given was to myself. I've come to realize the book on the good was not lost in a fire. It's here for you to read. Joel Alperson, January 2019.